Do you really think that any of these lines will lead to anything, Poirot?
Oh, it is always possible. In the midst of tragedy, we start the comedy. Is it not so?
What on earth are you talking about?
Did you not notice the sudden jealousy of Miss Gray when Mr. Clark suggested he might have a word with the waitress? Enter.
Oh, Miss Gray.
Forgive me, but I thought there was something I should tell you, Monsieur Poirot.
But certainly, mademoiselle.
It is just this. Mr. Clark very generously gave you to understand that I left his brother's house at my own wish. But as a matter of fact, it was not quite like that. Hmm? Lady Clark insisted that I should leave. But she suddenly took an unreasoning dislike to me and insisted that I should leave the house.
Well, I think it's splendid of you to come and tell us this.
It is always better to tell the truth. Hmm. I didn't want to shelter behind Mr. Clark's chivalry.
You have been very honest, mademoiselle.
It was rather a blow to me. I always thought Lady Clark was rather fond of me. One lives and learns. That was all I had to say. Goodbye, Monsieur Poirot.
Au revoir, mademoiselle.
Captain Hastings.
Oh. Well, I call that very sporting of her. She's got courage, that girl.
And calculation.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that she takes care to safeguard herself.
She is certainly a lovely girl.
I cannot rid my mind of the impression that something was said in our conversation this afternoon that was significant. But I cannot pin down what it was. No matter. Presently it will come to me. In the meantime, there is Lady Clark. Perhaps she will enlighten me on her reason for dismissing your beautiful Miss Gray.
I never thought it would be that way round. I was so sure that I should be the first to go. Carr was never ill. Was it Franklin who asked you to come here?
Yes, Lady Clark.
I do hope he isn't going to be foolish over that girl. He's so easily taken in, despite having knocked around the world so much.
He has an impulsive nature.
Oh, yes. And so very chivalrous. Everything is so dim. One's body is such a nuisance when it gets the upper hand. One is conscious of nothing else, whether the pain will hold off or not.
I know, Lady Clark. It is one of the tragedies of this life.
It makes one so stupid. I can't even remember what it was I wanted to say to you.
Was it something to do with your husband's death?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. It must have been. Mad, poor creature. The murderer, I mean. I've always been so sorry for mad people. You haven't caught him yet?
No, not yet.
The man must have been hanging round the house all day.
But no stranger came to the house.
Who says so?
The servants? Miss Gray?
Oh, that girl is a liar. I didn't like her. Carr thought the world of her. Such a good worker, he said. So brave. She was supposed to be an orphan. I soon sent her packing. Franklin had the impertinence to suggest that she might be a comfort to me. Comfort to me. The only thing that would give comfort to me, I told him, would be to see the back of her. I didn't want her to make a fool of Franklin. I didn't want him to get mixed up with her. He's like a boy. No sense. That's one thing about being ill. People can't argue with you.
Why did you say that Miss Gray was a liar?
Because she is. You said that she told you no one came to the house that day.
Yes.
Very well, then. I saw her with my own eyes out of this window talking to a perfectly strange man on the doorstep.
Huh? What did the man look like?
An ordinary sort of man.
A tradesman?
No. A shabby sort of person. I can't remember. I'm a little tired. Ah, please, Please, you must go now. Forgive me.
By the time Poirot returned from Devon, the fourth letter, written in that painstakingly careful print with which we were by now all too familiar, had arrived for him.
Still no success. What do you and the police think you are doing? Poor Mr. Poirot, I'm quite sorry for you. We've a long way still to go. Tipperary? No, that comes further on. The next little incident will take place at Doncaster on September 11th. So long, ABC. We had better inform Inspector Crom Hastings.
Right.
And warn Mr. Clark to be ready for action.
I'll take the letter with me, if I may, Mr. Poirot, for our fingerprint experts. If you'd care to make a copy...
No, it is not necessary.
What are your plans, Inspector?
Fairly comprehensive ones, Mr. Clark.
You've got a tricky task on your hands. And what the fancy old ABC has done you again.
The public won't have much to criticise in our arrangements this time. The 11th is until Wednesday of next week. That gives us ample time for a publicity campaign in the press. And we'll draft extra police into Doncaster on a fairly large scale. The whole of the town, police and civilians, will be out to catch one man. And with reasonable luck, we ought to get him.
It's easy to see you're not a sporting man, Inspector.
What do you mean by that?
Well, don't you realise that next Wednesday the St. Ledger is being run at Doncaster?
I hadn't taken that into account. It does rather complicate matters.
Oh, ABC is no fool, even if he is a madman.
Quite ingenious. It is well planned, one has to admit it.
It's my belief that the murder will be committed on the racecourse, while the St. Ledger is actually being run.
I'll telephone the Assistant Commissioner, if I may, Mr. Poirot.
By all means, Inspector. And we had better convene an emergency session of the Secret Legion, Mr. Clark.
But how can we be on the lookout for this man when we know nothing about him?
None of us has ever seen him or spoken to him. We've all gone over everything that we know, over and over again.
Not everything. For instance, Miss Gray told us that she did not see or speak to any stranger at the house on the day that Sir Carmichael was murdered.
Yes, that's right.
Is it? Then why did Lady Clark tell me that she saw you from her window standing on the front doorstep talking to a man?
Lady Clark must have made a mistake. But I never spoke to... Oh, I remember now. How stupid. I'd forgotten all about it, but it wasn't important. Just one of those people who come round selling stockings. I was just crossing the hall when he came to the door. But he was quite a harmless sort of person. I suppose that's why I forgot all about him.
Stockings. Stockings. What is it? What is it that I'm trying to remember? Ah, bon Dieu, I have it.
You have what, Poirot?
You remember the shop in Andover? In Mrs. Ashe's bedroom, on a chair, we found a pair of new stockings.
Yes.
And Mother bought Betty a pair of new stockings on the day before the murder.
It is the same pattern, three times repeated. That cannot be a coincidence. Now tell me, mademoiselle, is it not true that your mother bought those stockings not at a shop, but from someone who came to the door?
Yes. Yes, she did. She said something about being sorry for those wretched men who go round and try to get orders.
But what's the connection? A man comes round selling stockings. That proves nothing.
Does it not? Three crimes, and every time a man comes round selling stockings and spying out the land. Describe him, mademoiselle.
I can't. He had glasses, I think, and a shabby overcoat.
Oh, come, mademoiselle, you can do better than that.
He stooped. I hardly looked at him. Well, he wasn't the sort of man you'd notice.
You're quite right, mademoiselle. The whole secret of the murders lies in your description of the murderer. He wasn't the sort of person you'd notice. There is no doubt about it. That is our murderer.
A second class return, please.
And where would that be to, sir?
Doncaster. I'm going to Doncaster.
And when would you be coming back, sir?
Oh, very soon. I don't think that I shall be staying long.
We all gathered together at Doncaster on the morning of the 11th of September. I was sure that we were building on a false hope, on the chance of recognising among a crowd of thousands of people a face glimpsed only for a moment.
But I told you, I never really looked at him. You're all depending on me, and I shall let you down, because even if I did see him again, well, I mightn't recognize him.
Now then, Mappetita, this is no time for the hysteria. You will certainly recognize that man if you see him again.
How can you be so sure?
Because, in the end, the red always succeeds the black.
What do you mean by that, Monsieur Poirot?
I speak the language of the tables. At roulette, there may be a long run on the black, but in the end, red must turn up.
You mean that luck always turns?
Exactly, Miss Trower. A murderer is always a gambler, and like many gamblers, a murderer often does not know where to stop. With each crime, his opinion of his own abilities is strengthened. His sense of proportion is warped. He does not say, I have been lucky. He only says, I have been clever. And his opinion of his cleverness grows. And then, mes amis, the ball spins, and the run of the colour is over.
You believe that will happen in this case?
I believe that our luck has already turned. The clue of the stockings was the beginning.
I must say you're very heartening, Monsieur Poirot. We all need a bit of comfort.
It seems to me highly problematical that we can accomplish anything of practical value.
Don't be such a defeatist, Don.
And now it is time to make the beginning. This morning, you will each cover a different area of the town. This afternoon, you will all concentrate your attention on the race course. Mr. Clark will give you the exact details. Now go and get whatever you need for the day. I warn you, it may be a long one. And you, my friend, you are determined to accompany the expedition?
Oh, yes. I shouldn't be happy staying here doing nothing.
And would I be correct in supposing that you intend to be a cavalier to one of the ladies?
Yes, that was the general idea.
Mm-hmm. And which lady do you propose to honour with your company?
I haven't really considered.
Oh. Miss Barnard, perhaps?
She's rather the independent type.
And Miss Grey?
That's a better idea.
Well, my friend, I'm sorry to interrupt your plans, but I must request you to turn your thoughts elsewhere.
Hmm?
The person you are to escort is Mary Drower. And I must request you not to leave her.
Why is that, Poirot?
Because, my good friend, her name begins with a D.
1 1 and 9 penny, please.
There you are, sir. And threepence change. The film's just beginning.
In a cinema. And I had 40 men out on the racecourse.
How was the man killed?
With a knife. And I have to admit, it was a pretty audacious piece of work. The killer was making his way out along the row. He pretended to stumble, and he leaned over the seat in front to pick up his hat. He stabbed the man sitting there and slipped an ABC guide under the seat. And nobody noticed. They just thought the fellow was asleep.
Has the dead man been identified?
He has. And ABC seems to have slipped up this time. The man was called Earlsfield. George Earlsfield.
Curious.
What's even more curious is that the chap sitting two seats away, the one who realised that the victim was not just having a good sleep, was a schoolmaster called Roger Downs. Did ABC simply get the wrong man, do you think?
There's a young lady here, Inspector, from the White Swan Hotel. She thinks she may have some information on the murder.
You better show her in then, Sergeant.
In you come, then, miss. This is Inspector Chrome and a French gentleman.
Belgian.
Do please sit down.
Thank you, sir.
What is your name?
Marjorie Stroud, sir.
And what have you to tell us?
It with a gentleman in room 15, sir. I went up to take him his hot water. I knocked on the door, otherwise I wouldn't have gone in. And he were at the basin, washing his hands.
Go on.
It's your hot water, sir, I said. Oh, I've already washed in cold, he said. And I happened to look in the basin, and it were all red, and he had his coat off. He were holding the sleeve of it as if he'd been washing it in the basin.
Can you describe this man for us?
Rather shabby looking. He stooped and wore glasses.
When was this?
About 4:45, sir.
But that was over 2 hours ago. Why didn't you contact us at once?
We didn't hear about the murder till 30 minutes ago. Then I sort of put two and two together.
Is this man still there, do you know?
I don't think so. One of the lads in the courtyard said he thought he saw him sneaking off that way.
We'll get over there straight away. Will you come with us, Mr. Poirot?
Here's the register, sir. It doesn't look as if he left a proper address.
Camden Town. And even that's probably not true. And what's his name? His writing's very cramped.
Alexander Bonaparte Cust.
A, B, C.
Looks as if he's done a runner, sir.
What about his luggage?
There's a good-sized suitcase left here, full of cardboard boxes.
Anything in them?
Stockings, sir. Silk stockings.
Congratulations, Mr. Poirot. Your hunch was right.
I hope that the Doncaster business might have knocked some of the stuffing out of Chrome. But now that you can see where he's going at last, there's no stopping him. He's managed to establish quite a detailed little timetable for ABC. Selling stockings in Andover and Bexhill and Churston. And he's found out the various hotels where he was staying. But that's only the half of it.
What's he discovered?
Well, he hasn't discovered anything. He's had a very useful tip-off from a man called Hartigan, whose girlfriend's mother lets out rooms at a house in Camden Town.
Camden Town?
He'd been reading about the case in the papers and got very suspicious on account of a chap called Cust, who'd had a room in the place for over a year.
What made him suspicious?
Well, apparently, Cust had told the people at the house that he was off to Cheltenham for a day or two. But Hartigan happened to be at Euston Station and noticed him getting on a train for Doncaster.
And what kind of a man did he say this Mr. Cust was?
Well, a man who'd come down in the world a bit. But the sort of creature you'd reckon would never harm a fly.
We've got him, Mr. Poirot. We've got him.
Oh, do take a seat, Inspector.
Thank you. Oh, hello, Jack.
I've been telling these good gentlemen about your little tip-off.
I didn't realise you'd heard about it. We went round to the house in Camden Town this morning. Cust came without any trouble. He seemed more bewildered than anything. A search of his rooms revealed a number of packages of hosiery, and at the back of the cupboard where they were stored, we found a parcel. Much the same size and shape, but which turned out to contain not silk stockings, but 8 new ABC guides.
And what did he say about those?
What you'd expect. He'd never seen them before in his life. But there was something else that we found. You see, there was no sign of the knife in his room.
It would have been the act of an imbecile to bring that back from Doncaster with him.
Just you wait, Mr. Poirot. I asked myself where in the house he might have hidden it, and I got the answer straight away. The hall stand.
Gosh!
No one ever moves a hall stand. With a lot of trouble, we got it out from the wall. Felt as if it weighed a ton, and there it was.
The knife?
The knife, Jap. Not a doubt of it. The dried blood's still on it.
But that's astonishing.
There is one minor little snag, but I'm sure there's an answer to it. Cust seems to have an alibi for the Bexhill killing. Some fanatical dominoes player who cornered him in the hotel in Eastbourne where he was staying and forced him to play dominoes until the small hours of the morning. However, we've got him for the Doncaster killing. A little task for you, perhaps, Poirot. Find out how he managed to strangle Betty Barnard while he was allegedly playing dominoes.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm off back to the yard.
Well, I may as well come with you.
So long, Poirot.
Goodbye, Inspector.
Goodbye, Jap. Mm-hmm.
Tell me, Hastings, do you consider the case ended?
Well, yes. Practically speaking, they've got the man, they've got most of the evidence.
But where is the motive?
The man's a madman.
The man. Until we know about the man, the mystery is as deep as ever. All along I have been groping my way, trying to get to know the murderer. And now I realise, Hastings, that I do not know him at all.
Well, that's easily arranged. Why don't you go and see this Alexander Bonaparte Cust for yourself? I don't imagine there'd be any difficulty.
Do you know who I am?
No. No, I can't say I do.
I am Hercule Poirot.
Oh, yes.
I am the man to whom you wrote the letters.
Those letters weren't written by me. I've said so over and over again.
But if you did not write them, who did?
An enemy. I must have an enemy. Everyone's hand has always been against me. All my life, nothing has gone right for me. I got this wound in my head in the war. I could never hold down a decent job after that. Towards the end, I'd hardly got enough left of my little savings to hold body and soul together. And then I got this offer to go round selling stockings.
But you are aware of the fact that the firm you say employed you deny all knowledge of you.
But I've got all their letters, telling me where to go and on what dates.
But the police say that those letters were written on your own typewriter.
But the typewriter was sent to me by the firm at the beginning of the job.
The letters were written after then, Mr. Cust. And what about the ABC guides that were found in your cupboard?
I knew nothing about them. I thought they were more packages of stockings. I didn't even bother to open them. It's all a plot against me, can't you understand? Look at the second crime, the murder at Bexhill. I was in an hotel playing dominoes.
You play the game very well, I understand.
Oh, yes, I do. I used to play every lunchtime at a cafe in the city. You meet a lot of interesting people that way. There was one gentleman who talked to me for hours. I've never forgotten him because of what he told me. I thought by the end that I'd known him all my life.
What was it he told you, Mr. Cust?
It gave me a turn. A nasty turn. We were talking about your fate being written in your hand. And he showed me his hand and the lines that showed he'd have two near escapes. One was being drowned and... I've forgotten what the other one was. And then he took my hand.
And what did he say he saw there?
He said I was going to be one of the most celebrated men in England before I died. Said the whole country would be talking about me. And then...
Yes, Mr. Cust?
He said it looked as though I might die a violent death. And he laughed. Almost looks as if you might die on the scaffold, he said. Well, he was only joking, but... Oh, it's my head, you see. I suffer badly with my head, and there are times when I don't know, when I don't know.
But you know, do you not, that you committed the murders?
Yes, I know.
But, I am right, am I not? You do not know why you did them.
No, I don't. I don't know why.
During the next few days, Poirot was very busy. There were mysterious comings and goings on which I was not invited to accompany him. He was always frowning to himself and talked very little, although he did, on one occasion, pay me a singularly backhanded compliment.
While I was asking myself certain questions, I remembered a remark of yours, a remark absolutely shimmering in its clear vision. Oh. Did I not once say you had a genius for stating the obvious? It is the obvious that I have neglected.
The following day, he asked me to call an emergency session of our special legion.
All along I have been worried about the why of this case. The mystery was not the mystery of the murders, but the mystery of ABC. Why did he find it necessary to commit these murders? And why did he select me as his adversary?
But what's the point of asking these questions now, Monsieur Poirot?
A man has been arrested. But for me, the mystery has not been solved, Mademoiselle Gray. Let me go back to the very beginning, the arrival of the first letter. It seemed to me at once that there was something very wrong about it.
And you were quite right.
But I did not pay sufficient attention to my feeling, my very strong feeling. And when the first murder was committed, and then the second, I concentrated on one question. Why did ABC need to commit these murders?
Isn't there such a thing as bloodlust?
You are quite right, mademoiselle. But a homicidal maniac desires to kill as many people as possible. Such a killer is consent to hide his traces, not to advertise them. When we consider the first three victims selected, the murderer could have done away with them without incurring any suspicion. Why did he feel it necessary to draw attention to himself?
Because he wanted to score over you.
It is a very pathetic motive for murder, Mr. Fraser. I found it quite inconceivable at this point to enter into the mind of the murderer, and yet I did feel that there were things I was beginning to learn about him.
What kind of things?
To begin with, He had a tabular mind. His crimes were listed by alphabetical progression, although the selection of his victims appeared to be completely haphazard. Then ABC suggested what I may call a railway-minded man. This is more common in men than in women, though I still did not rule a woman out. It might perhaps be the sign of an underdeveloped mind.
You mean a kind of overgrown schoolboy?
Exactly. The death of Betty Barnard and the manner of her death gave certain other indications. To begin with, she was strangled with her own belt. And it was what you said to me, Mademoiselle Megan, that instantly confirmed the way I was thinking.
You mean what I said about her being a shameless flirt? Sorry, Dom, but it was true, you know it.
She liked attention from a personable male. Therefore, ABC had to be a person with le sex appeal. I visualized the scene of Betty's death thus. They walk together on the beach. The man admires her belt. She takes it off. He passes it playfully round her neck, pretending to strangle her. She giggles, and the pretense becomes the reality.
Mr. Poirot, for God's sake.
I say no more. It is over. Then came the third murder of Sir Carmichael, and then the fourth. But by then we had obtained a vital indication.
The man selling stockings.
And the police found the sleeve of his jacket was all bloody.
And the knife behind the hall stand.
And he was arrested and charged.
And will probably end his days in Broadmoor.
Except for one little thing. Alexander Bonaparte Cust has an alibi for the night of the crime at Bexhill.
Yes, that's been worrying me all along.
Which leads us to two very interesting speculations. Supposing that he did not commit the murder at Bexhill.
But, Mr. Poirot, that just doesn't make sense.
Be quiet, mademoiselle. I am for the truth. Supposing somebody had forestalled him, what would he do? Commit a second murder? Or lie low and accept the death of Betty Barnard as a kind of macabre present?
But surely all the crimes must have been committed by the same person.
Exactly, Mademoiselle Grey. Supposing that someone else committed the Bexhill crime, could that person have been responsible for the other crimes also? I did then what I should have done at first. I examined the letters again. I had thought that what was wrong with them was that they had been written by a madman, but this time I came to a totally different conclusion. What was wrong with them was that they had been written by someone who was totally sane.
But the man couldn't possibly have been sane.
Merci. Was it not your great Shakespeare who has said you cannot see the trees for the wood?
I don't think he actually...
Where do you notice a pin least? When it is in a pin cushion. When do you notice an individual murder least? When it is one of a series of unrelated murders. I realized I had to deal with an intensely clever, resourceful murderer, a person who had thought up a most fantastical defense for himself, to create a homicidal murderer.
Surely that's impossibly far-fetched.
Do you think so? I had now to review the ABC murders to trace the guilty person. I could hardly imagine Mrs. Asher's broken alcoholic of a husband carrying out such an elaborate scheme. Betty Barnard's fiancé, Donald Fraser, was a possibility...
But Don isn't that kind of person.
Precisely, mademoiselle. His motive could only be jealousy, and jealousy does not tend to premeditation. But when we come to the Carmichael crime, we are on infinitely more promising ground.
What exactly do you mean by that, Monsieur Poirot?
Sir Carmichael Clarke was an immensely rich man. Who inherits his money? His wife, who has only a few months left to live. And then it goes to his brother, Franklin Clarke.
But what possible motive could I have for killing Carr?
Your motive, Mr. Clarke, is sitting by your side. Miss Thora Gray.
Nothing whatever to do with it.
You told my friend Hastings, Mr. Clarke, of the great affection your brother had for Miss Grey. He was like a father to her, you said. You knew very well that there was a very strong chance that on the death of your sister-in-law, Sir Carmichael would turn to this beautiful girl for sympathy and comfort, and that it might end, as so often happens with elderly men, in his marrying her. You judged, correctly or not, that Miss Grey was a young woman on the make.
That's a monstrous thing to say.
You had no doubt that she would jump at the chance of becoming Lady Clark. There might be children, and your chance of inheriting your brother's fortune would vanish.
This is all very ingenious and fanciful, Monsieur Poirot. But what about the wretched Mr. Cust caught red-handed? What about the blood in his coat? And the knife he hid in his lodgings? He may deny the crime.
On the contrary, he admits the fact.
Well, and sure.
He has neither the nerve nor the daring, nor, I may add, the brains to conceive the plan and carry it out. But you, Mr. Clark, fit the personality of ABC quite perfectly. The attractive, free and easy manner. Nothing simpler for you than to pick up Betty Barnard. The meticulous, tabular mind. Remember the notes you made at our meetings. And the irrepressible, boyish enthusiasm.
But how can you account for the fact that Cust...
It was not enough for you, Mr. Clark, to devise this plan of a series of crimes to divert attention from the single crime you intended to commit. You needed also to have a stoking horse. Mr. Cust has told me of an encounter with a stranger in a London coffee house. You were that stranger, Mr. Clark. Cust was exactly the kind of shrinking and insignificant person you needed. His absurdly bombastic Christian names, spelling out ABC, gave you the basis for the whole alphabetical plan.
Because the man he was intending to murder began with a C.
You made your arrangements very carefully. You sent a letter to Cust, purporting to come from a hosiery firm, offering him a good salary and a generous commission. In Cust's name, you wrote for a large consignment of hosiery to be sent to him, and then you subsequently sent him a parcel of ABCs, packed up so that he would think it was another consignment of stockings. You knew very well that he would not bother to open it until the first batch was exhausted. Your plans were so well laid beforehand that you typed all the letters that were to be sent to him, telling him what places he should call at with the stockings, in advance. For you had planned on exactly what dates the murders would be committed. And when you had written all your letters to Mr. Cust, you sent off to him the machine on which they had been typed, as if from the hosiery company, stating that it had been loaned to him for his work.
But what was the point of that?
So that when the police found the typewriter, they would recognize it as the machine on which all the letters had been typed, and Cust would be accused of having set up the whole operation himself.
And that, of course, was exactly what happened.
By the time Cust received the letters from what he believed to be the hosiery firm, your first two victims had already been selected.
A and B.
Just so. Mrs. Asher's name was written above her shop for all the world to see, and since she was often alone in there, disposing of her presented you with very little difficulty. In Betty Barnard, you found exactly the easy-going, gullible girl to suit your purpose. On the days you had told me the murder would occur, Cust followed his instructions and obediently presented himself at Andover and Bexhill, and you carried out the murders as you had planned.
How unutterably cold-blooded!
Which brings us to the third murder. The real murder, from your point of view, Mr. Clark. In your letters to me, you had given ample warning of ABC's intentions, which was all very well for a town like Andover or Bexhill. But since Churston has so few inhabitants, you had to commit the murder before the police arrived on the scene. And so you arranged for your third letter to me...
to be sent deliberately to the wrong address. That's what I said.
And no one paid any attention to you. From the very beginning, I could not understand why the letters had been sent to me personally and not to the police or to a newspaper. And then I realized why I had been chosen. The third letter had to go astray. This could hardly happen to a letter sent to Scotland Yard or to a newspaper, but a private address was another matter. All you had to do was to make a deliberate error, so that by the time the letter reached me, the crime would have been committed.
But what about Mr. Cust? He must have committed the fourth murder.
By the time Mr. Clark had reached the letter D, it mattered very little who was the victim. By way of our special legion, you were able, Mr. Clark, to arrange to be on the scene yourself. Mr. Cust had been instructed by the hosiery firm to go to Doncaster, and your plan was to follow him around and trust to opportunity. Mr. Cust went to a cinema, and from then, it was simplicity itself. You took a seat a little way away from him. When he got up to go, you did the same. You pretended to stumble and stabbed a man asleep in the row in front and slipped the ABC onto his knees. You contrived to collide with Mr. Cust in the darkness, wiped your knife on his sleeve, and slipped it into his pocket.
But did Mr. Cust really believe that he had committed the murder?
People in Mr. Cust's condition often have blanks in their memory, and they cannot recall what they have done. He was nervous, highly neurotic, and very susceptible. He had been in Andover and Bexhill and Cheston, and his mind was already in a state of confusion as to whether he might be the murderer. The blood on his sleeve, the knife in his pocket, were the final confirmation.
It's an ingenious theory, Monsieur Poirot, but you really don't have a single shred of proof.
No, that is not so, Mr. Clark. You were quite safe so long as no one suspected you, but once I was certain that you were the murderer, proofs were not difficult to come by.
What kind of proofs?
Your photograph was picked out from half a dozen others by two people who had seen you leaving the cinema at Doncaster. At a time when you were supposed to be on the race course, keeping an eye out for the murderer.
Well, hardly very conclusive.
Millie Bigley, a waitress at a cafe in Bexhill, recognized you as the man who took Betty Barnard out for a drive on that fatal evening. And finally, most damning of all, your fingerprint was found on one of the keys of the typewriter you sent to Cust, which, if you are innocent, you could never have handled.
So, Monsieur Poirot, it looks as if my luck has run out. You said that Red would be bound to turn up in the end. But it was worth a gamble.
It's no good you're looking round for a way of escape, Mr. Clark. The building is surrounded.
Who the devil are you?
Chief Inspector Japp of Scotland Yard. I must warn you that anything you may say may be used in evidence against you.
I have nothing to say.
Take him down to the car, Sergeant.
Sir.
I can't wait to see Crome's face when he learns about this. He was so certain that he'd got his man.
So, what's to become of the unfortunate Mr. Cust?
He has already been released. Huh? One of the popular newspapers has been pestering him for his life story. He told me they had offered him £100.
And what did you advise him to do?
I told him to settle for nothing less than 500, and not to confine himself to one paper. I also told him that he was now a very famous man. At last, he can live up to his extravagant Christian names.
Alexander Bonaparte. You know, Poirot, it was that fingerprint on the typewriter that really clinched it. It completely finished Franklin Clark off.
Yes, they are useful things, the fingerprints. I put that in for you, my friend.
You mean to say it wasn't true?
Not in the least. It is not the clues that count, the footprints and the traces of cigarette ash, but the steady penetration into the mind of the murderer. And there is only one way by which that can be achieved.
And what's that, Poirot?
By exercising the little grey cells, mon ami. The little grey cells.
In Agatha Christie's The ABC Murders, Hercule Poirot was played by John Moffat. Captain Hastings, Simon Williams. Chief Inspector Japp, Philip Jackson. Franklin Clark, John Rye. Alexander Bonaparte Cust, Johan Meredith. Lady Clark, Jane Wenham. Inspector Crome, Tom George. Thora Gray, Lucy Patterson, Mary Drower, Gemma Saunders, Megan Barnard, Beth Chalmers, Donald Fraser, Christopher Kellen, Marjorie Stroud, Zena Harding Roots, the police sergeant, Tim Treloar. Other parts were played by members of the cast. The ABC Murders was dramatized for radio by Michael Bakewell and directed by Enid Williams.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.